Hey, and just a quick reminder that the audio-only versions of these Vital MX interviews are available on the Vital MX podcast page. Search for it anywhere you get your pods and let your friends know about it. What's up? Back with another Vital MX Industry Insights. This week, I've got writer and founder of Buzz Media, Dale Spangler, on the line. What's up, Dale?
How are you, Jamie? I'm happy to be on the show, and yeah, it's kind of a nice, warm spring day here in Boise, Idaho, so can't really complain.
Dude, I got to get to Boise one of these days. I keep hearing how beautiful it is, and I've just never been.
Yeah, actually, funny story. You know, I worked for a little while for Tucker Rocky, you know, now Tucker Power Sports, and so my wife and I actually moved for a year, almost a year. We didn't make it quite a year, but to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and we lived in Fort Worth for a year and then moved back here and right before COVID hit and been here ever since. My wife's born and raised in Idaho, so she was like, yeah, I'm not really feeling the Texas life, so we moved back up here to Boise.
No comment. Well, Dale, the way I like to start these Industry Insight pods is just with some of your background. I want to know where you grew up, how you first got into moto. I don't know if it was a family thing or a friend. So, yeah, let's get some of your background. Tell us where you grew up.
Yeah, so I grew up, you know, it's funny, but I think now I'm almost spent half of my life now in Idaho. But I grew up in Northeast Ohio, east of Cleveland, up on Lake Erie, in a little town called Painesville, one town over from Mentor, Ohio, where a lot of people might be familiar with Weisco Piston and Cometic Gasket. They're both out of Mentor, Ohio. And ironically enough, my first industry job was with Cometic Gasket there in Ohio back in 93. But anyways, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. But
that's okay.
Yeah, so I started racing when I was 12. Well, I guess I'll back up a little further. My first bike was a Z50. And I think that was like a 76 or something like that. You know, so I grew up riding mini bikes. And my dad was a drag racer, and so I think he just had the bug to where he stopped drag racing, and he just kind of still had the racing bug. And so he took me to a local motocross race at this track called Ohio International in Ravenna, Ohio. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, that's what I want to do. So I think it was maybe 2-3 weeks later, 1981 YZ80 showed up at the house, and that was it, man. We were off and running after that. I think my dad he wanted to be so into the racing scene again, even if he couldn't, you know, do it himself. So I think he was kind of like maybe a little bit vicariously living through me, you know, going to the races. But yeah, just kind of the classic story. Started racing at 12 and did the Loretta thing and ended up getting a Team Green ride and turned pro in 88. And, rode a couple years pro, and then my dad and I graduated in 87, mm-hmm. and my dad and I had this like kind of 3-year informal pact where it's like, okay, if you don't have a factory ride by the time, you know, 3 years from when I graduated, then you're kind of on your own. Maybe you should think about doing something else. And so I made it to the 3 years. I was close. You know, I think I was in the running for a Suzuki ride for 1990. I had national number 41 going into that year, and I didn't even race. You know, I ended up going to work and getting a normal job and, you know, kind of finding my way, trying to be normal, air quotes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll get to the racing and stuff a little bit more, but like, I want to ask your dad being a drag racer, you're a little kid. Was he doing that? Like, do you remember him drag racing, or was that pre-memory?
Yeah, I don't remember it because lots of photos of me in like a baby seat with next to my mom in the chase vehicle for the drag races, but I don't remember it.
Okay, the reason I wanted to see if at a young age maybe you had some interest in that until you found moto, but you didn't really grow up around it too much.
No, not at all. Yeah, so my dad got me. I think my dad had like a Bull Taco Sherpa 250 or something, and so then he got me that Z50 so we could go riding together. And the funny story is my dad was a horrible rider. He was terrible. Like, he crashed all the time. And so it was just like, you know, later on when he was my mechanic, you know, like the father-son team at the races, like, he would take my bike out after rebuilding the top end. I'd be like, Dad, you can't ride my bike again. Because, like, he'd go out and grab a handful of front brake and crash in the slippery grass and bend my handlebars.
Oh, jeez. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about some amateurs. You talked about going to Loretta's. I read that in 84, you won the 125C championship at the Florida Winter AMA Series. Then you went to Loretta's a few times. I think you got third in 89 on the 125A. So your amateur career looks like it was pretty good. I mean, yeah, talk about that. Where you were racing, how you were progressing. You said Team Green Ride, obviously. That means you were doing well. How'd that come about?
Yeah, so I was kind of like, you know, doing my thing, you know, racing kind of regional stuff, you know, in Northeast Ohio. I'd go down to Western Pennsylvania a lot. Like, that's where I met people like Davey Coons, because we raced against each other. We were about the same age, you know, racing B classes and A classes coming up together. And so, yeah, I was kind of doing my regional thing, and would go to High Point every year for the spring Team Green National they had there. In fact, I think the year I graduated, I went to the Team Green National instead of actually going to my high school graduation. You
can imagine that. That's great.
So, yeah, like, things were going well, and I was doing well, you know, I was pretty much winning most of the B class stuff. And when I turned A, I was a front runner and got the phone call from, I think it was Bruce Sternstrom at the time, was the Team Green manager. And God, what a feeling, you know, like when you get a call like that from somebody that you look up to, and you kind of feel like, oh, they're just, you know, this unobtainable, you know, position to be a Team Green rider. And then you get that phone call. I mean, it was the coolest feeling ever. Like, I think my first year I got like a discount on bikes, but then the next year I got three bikes, I think. And so it was just an amazing feeling, like what a boost in your confidence when you get that kind of Team Green seal of approval. And so each year going to Loretta Lynn's, I kind of felt like that just gave me that little extra confidence boost that, hey, you know, like I'm one of the kind of key players coming down here.
Yeah, I would have no idea what that feels like, Dale. Definitely never had that much ability, but like your third at Loretta's was the guy that finished second was a guy named Mike LaRocco. I'm sure that name will ring a bell to our listeners. That's pretty impressive. A really cool class of riders back in that late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, yeah. So many. Yeah, it's funny, but like everybody talks about how stacked it is now, but, you know, like even back then, you know, you look at some of the names in that and those, you know, 125A classes, mm-hmm. It was, you know, kind of a who's who that went on to do really well in the outdoor nationals. Like you said, LaRocco and Mike Kudrowski and Denny Stevenson. And, you know, like, I mean, it was just an unbelievable group of riders. And, you know, I think that's just the way it is with racing. You know, like as the sport progresses, you know, like where we're at now, obviously I look at it and I go, they're just going so much faster than we were back then. But, you know, it's the bikes and, you know, there's a lot of little factors, but, you know, I think every generation thinks that probably a little bit. Like,
yeah, of course.
It was stacked, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's a lot of factors that play into the stack class, the bike, the type of bikes. It's been a progression, but those years were pretty impressive. And you go pro, you talked about that already, and you had some really good results. You had a number of top 10s. You had some top fives in Supercross and the 125 Supercross days. I think you had a third in a moto and a national at Redbud. So really, yeah. Over the, what you said, 4 years or so you were pro, like really some really good results, just not quite enough to get that factory ride.
Yeah, you know, probably the closest thing I had to a factory ride was, so I had a span where, as I mentioned, you know, I kind of like quit, didn't even race with my national number 41 in 1990. It took, I think it was 3 years. I tried to be normal. I worked construction, got a drafting degree so I could be a construction estimator. You know, I tried all these like normal things, and I'm like, it really isn't all it's cracked up to be. So I tried to make a comeback at 93, wrote from 93 to 95, and I got a ride with F&S Suzuki, which I don't know if you remember that team back in the day, but mm-hmm. Gosh, they were just, man, they had so many riders, like tons of good riders. They were out of like Southeast Ohio, I think Dayton, Ohio. So, like, I ended up getting, like, three or four bikes from them for the 95 season. I was lucky enough at the Troy National. I got enough points to get national number 90 for 95. So, I was able to kind of get all that stuff going and had a fantastic ride, but I just kept getting hurt. You know, I broke both my wrists at the same time and then went to an arena cross maybe, I don't know, 6-8 weeks later, thinking I could come back quickly and re-broke the right wrist again. And so, that was kind of it. You know, I went to the, I think it was the Charlotte Supercross was the last pro race I did, and I was just scared. You know, like my wrists were hurting, and I was over jumping stuff and casing things. And so it was just, when you get to that point, I feel like where you're scared to get out there, then you know it's time to probably hang up the boots a little.
Yeah, it's time to wrap it up. And just for our younger listeners, when you hear some of those results, those were really good results that I mentioned, but there weren't all these satellite teams back there to get extra rides. Like, you were either a privateer or you were factory, pretty much. There wasn't a lot of, well, I mean, Pro Circuit was around, but there wasn't Star Racing and Team Solitaire, and, you know, PMRX. Those teams didn't exist to help guys like yourself.
No, I mean, probably the two main teams that I rode for, of course, were FNS and Tough Racing. And kind of in conjunction with getting my Team Green ride, the guys from Tough Racing called me up. You know, it was Dave Anilak and I forget the, it was Ron Joint. Yeah, Ron Joint was there, the guy.
Decal Works.
You know, Decal Works. Yeah, so he was originally at Tough Racing. He was the one that actually called me, Ron Joint. We want you to be a part of Tough Racing. And so during my Team Green years and 1 year into Suzuki in 89, we switched to Suzuki's that year on Tough. But, yeah, so I rode for them until I quit in 89. And then when I came back, I was an FNS rider. But like you said, you know, there was kind of these privateer teams, but certainly not to the level we see today, you know, with
right. Semis
and all that. We were the box truck era.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But okay. You get these injuries and now it is time to be quote unquote, as you said, normal. And you said your first job was at Cometic Gaskets. Was that after the Supercross professional years or was that during?
During. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was like 93. I took the job and then right then I started racing again. And so I was like, it's fine to do both. You know, juggling, you know, trying to train and race on the weekend. And then, you know, 5 days a week, I'd go in. You know, strangely enough, they hired me at Cometic because I think I mentioned I got that, you know, drafting degree, computer drafting degree. And so they had me drawing, like, we didn't even have a scanner when I first started at Cometic. So I would get, like, a base gasket, and we'd have to, like, reproduce a stock Kawasaki gasket, for example. And I'd have to draw this thing with calipers and measure it all out and make a computer drawing that we'd send to a water jet or we'd make a die stamp out of it. And so that's what I was doing when I first started working there. And then I just eventually started to take a little interest in marketing. And I said, hey, would you mind if I start going to the races and maybe set up a tent? And so that kind of launched me into the marketing phase of my career. And it seemed like after that, that's where I ended up going as far as, you know, job roles and, you know, content creation roles, marketing roles.
Yeah. At this point, you have 30 plus years in the marketing and in a marketing role. You've worked with, from what I've read, Alpine Stars, I know WPS, Smith Goggles, I think Pro Moto Billet and Fantasy Fastway Performance. A lot of major players in the game. Kind of how did you get involved with those companies with no marketing background? How did you get your first start? What was the first company you worked for?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, but like, I just tell people, like, you just can't network enough, you mm-hmm. know, and that's what I just kind of take it back to. You know, I was working at Cometic. Things were kind of chugging along there. I want to say it was, I think it was 1996. And I decided, you know, I want to do something different. And so I gave, you know, a phone call to Davey Coombs. And I said, hey, if you happen to, you know, you're a guy that's always getting people calling you all the time on a daily basis. If you hear someone that's looking, you know, to fill a marketing role, I'd be interested. Well, I think it was 2 or 3 days later, Davey calls me. He's like, I got a job for you, but it's in Italy.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? You know? And so he's like, yeah, it's Alpine Stars. You know, they want to interview you. So I flew out to Washougal, did like an interview with Gabriella, the owner. We walked around all weekend, you know, talking to riders and stuff. And he said, you got the job. So I actually had to move to Italy, to Oslo, Italy. So I was the first American to move over there in 1997. And my job was media relations. And so I kind of learned how to do media relations over there from Gabrielle and the Alpine Stars team. And so I'd load up a van with Alpine Stars stuff and drive to Paris, France, or, you know, like Madrid, Spain, and visit editorial offices and go to races. That was my job for 2 years.
Okay, that's interesting because, one, very little background, right, other than professional background, the networking. You're in a foreign country doing a job you've really never done. You don't probably know your way around that well. Maybe there might be some communication issues there. Like, how do you work through that? I mean, obviously, you just do it and you figure it out, but had to be a little scary.
Absolutely. I think that what I had in my favor, I was just kind of like the ignorant, naive American going over there. You know, like, I didn't, like you said, I didn't know the language. You know, I think I was just, you know, kind of naive enough that I just, and open-minded enough that I went over there and just had a great mentor that really, like, when I first got there, Davide Trolli, his name was, worked for Alpine Stars, Italian guy. He was my mentor. We hopped in the van. The first race we went to, I think a week after I was there, we were going to Brno, Czech Republic, for a 500 MotoGP race. And so load up the van, you know, we're driving, and that we still had border crossings then. So pretty interesting, you know, getting into other countries. So we get to the Czech border, and, you know, like, we pull up, and Davide's like, all these guards come out with rifles and everything. They're like, oh, you've got stuff in here. They see the Alpine Stars on the side, like, you need to pay some duties here to get into the country. And Davide's like, hold on a second, watch this. And he goes in the back and he grabs T-shirts for every one of the guards, hands them out, stamp our passports, and we're through and into the Czech Republic. That was my first experience about a week and a half into living in Italy.
Yeah, well, that sounds like an important lesson you needed to know. Yeah.
So it was a wild time, though, because I slept in that van a lot. Like, it was, you know, like, I tell people, like, if you can drive around Europe for a couple years with just an atlas map, no cell phone to navigate for you, and find places in a foreign language, like being in Paris, France, and having to find a magazine when everything's called Rue Day, you know, not easy.
No, that's it takes us. I think it takes a certain personality, obviously, to do something like that. It's just not just anybody can go do that. There's a lot of anxiety people would have, and you have to be a certain type of person.
Absolutely. Like, to me, I think it just, for more than anything, it really kind of, like, broadened my horizons, sort of opened up my eyes. Like, I've always been a pretty naturally curious person, to where, you know, like, I like learning about languages and cultural things. And so I think that helped me a lot. Like, I wasn't afraid to try different foods. And, you know, like, I remember some of the crusty guys came over when I was at Alpine Stars, and all they wanted to do was eat at McDonald's, you know? So it's just like, to me, I think that's what helped me kind of enjoy the process a little bit more, is to be a little open-minded. And when I had a week off, we'd go explore towns, you know, like, I was the first American over there. Then a bunch more came after I did. And we all lived in this apartment, you know, above the Alpine Stars factory, which is kind of strange, but it worked.
Yeah. I mean, a hell of a cool life experience and makes for cool stories. Another place you worked that I thought was really, there's a cool story behind, was when you worked at Smith, and I know you worked with Greg Albertine. He won a 250 MX championship in 99. That's when you were there, I believe. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, talk about a stressful time. And it's funny, like, I feel like I've told this story a couple times, one time probably to Mathis, you know. But
nobody listens to that show.
I mean, just, you know, being a goggle guy is one of the toughest jobs, in my opinion, out there, you know. And so, you know, like, those couple of years at Smith really just burned me out. You know, like, by the end of my tenure at Smith, which is 2004, I was ready to, like, be off the road. Because, you know, I was that guy like you guys, where I was going to, well, luckily we had Rich Taylor, we had Mark Ferris, and myself. Between the three of us at Smith, we kind of divided up, going to the races, going to supercrosses, going to outdoors, getting all the rider their goggles. Well, we didn't have a rig, nothing, you know? So it was like night before, I'm at High Point in, I think it was like 98 or 99, like when Albertine, like you said, was winning the championship, and I'm stressed out. I've got goggles in my room. I'm building roll-offs because it's going to rain the next day. And yeah, it was definitely stressful times, but it was cool though to win that championship for Smith, because that was the first time they actually got, you know, a major championship like that. So for them, it was a pretty big deal. So pretty proud of that one.
Yeah, you have, you know, you talked about a couple of these stories now. They're a little bit stressful, but in the end, looking back, they're great stories. I mean, you lived a really cool life and got to do some things that a lot of people would dream of doing.
Yeah, it's funny, but I keep thinking about it lately. I've talked to numerous people, and I'm like, these stories like this, when I get rolling, I'm like, I need to write these down, because I feel like in some ways I could probably write like a book of short stories with all the different episodes like that I experienced in Italy and just throughout my career, because there's just so many, so many stories like that. I could go on and on.
Well, let's talk about currently. You own Buzz Media, buzzmediacontent.com, where you help other companies with marketing. That's something that you've done your whole life, pretty much. Learned a lot, so now you're helping others, including Dust Moto. We're going to be doing an industry insight with those guys pretty soon. Pit Pass Moto, EVS, Onyx Off-Road, Wiseco, numerous other companies. How did Buzz Media get started? What was the genesis of, you know, you taking a chance on that?
Yeah, it's weird, but I back up to, You know, I started Buzz Media, I think it was 2016.
Okay.
I created that LLC. My wife's, works for a law firm, so she's able to kind of do that stuff. She's like, I started this website, Dirt Buzz, and that was kind of like my attempt at creating a news website that was focused primarily on off-road only. So, like, at the time, I felt like GNCC, Works, all that kind of stuff was just kind of overlooked a lot. Everything was moto-focused, and so I focused on primarily off-road stuff, and then I had people like, strangely enough, Jerry Bernardo, if you remember him from the past.
ESPN 2, baby.
He reached out to me. Yeah, I mean, he reached out to me randomly through my website and said, I like to write too. You know, that's all he said. You know, Jerry Bernardo. I'm like, Jerry Bernardo, like, what the heck? So I'm like, I reply to him, and I'm like, this is Dale Spangler. He's like, oh my God, you know, I didn't even know it was you. And so he's like, he starts sending me these old stories that he wrote that were just incredible. You know, like, just to me, to this day, he's still one of those people that just, he's so out there, like, his mind makes an absolutely incredible writer. Like, his stuff is super interesting, quirky. So anyway, he starts sending me all these stories, and I'm trying to make a go of this Dirt Buzz and maybe look for sponsors. And I get to the point where it's getting enough traffic where I think, yeah, I could probably approach some sponsors. And I realize that I hate asking, people for money.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah. So I kind of like, I still have that website. It's out there. It's got a ton of great content. And I mentioned I was working for Tucker Power Sports at the time. Well, when COVID hit, I got furloughed. That was 2020. Got furloughed, got laid off 3 months later, got my position eliminated. So yeah, spring of 2020, right when COVID's hitting. And so I'm like, well, I looked around for a job for about 3 months, and it's crazy. But when you get to my age, I just turned 55, like, ageism is a real thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of hard to find a job at my age. Cause like, in some ways I'm either, people look at me and they say, you have too much experience, or I'm too old, and so it's like, it's really, really, really hard. So after 3 months of kind of unsuccessful job hunting, I just decided to do my own thing, and started reaching out to some brands that had good connections. Again, kind of to go back to that networking, to me, that's just been the biggest thing in my whole life. Like, I'm not sure I've ever really gotten a job off a resume, to be honest. Like, it's always been, seemed like, through some type of a connection. And so, yeah, this has been, I'm a little over 3 years now with Buzz Media, and, started out doing PR, and I'm doing some blogs, and now, like, I'm writing weekly blogs for eBay Motors, and I got a decent list of clients where, I'm not killing it, I'm not getting rich by any means, but I love the schedule, I'm my own boss, and the freedom's fantastic, so I don't see myself going back at this point.
And do you find joy in doing those things? And I know you're involved, obviously, with Pit Pass Moto, and then you've done the Dirt Buzz podcast. Do you enjoy the writing and the PR and the podcast? Does that give you what you need every day?
Yeah, I really just love telling. Like, some of my favorite projects are the ones, like, I've done some great pieces for Meta and Vana. It's now Vana, of course, with Meta Magazine. Like, kind of the more in-depth pieces. I wrote a piece on Wesley Schultz of the Lumineers, how he uses motorcycles to write his music. Did another music piece recently on a young musician named Connor, another writer. So, like, those type of stories where I get to really dig in and just, another one is Gold Creek Lodge. Have you heard of that place up in Northern Idaho?
Yeah, that guy, that Mathis guy, I heard him talk about it, yes.
Yes, you know. So yeah, that place. So I got to go up there last summer and with the Vana crew, and write a story about the history of the Gold Creek Lodge, how the whole thing came about, and I just love, like, telling those types of stories that are, entertaining, useful, helpful information, build people up instead of, there's so much negativity, as we know, out there. Like, it's nice to do things that build people up and shine a light on people. I mean, that's a lot of what I was trying to do with the Pit Pass Moto podcast, which I did recently actually leave on February 1st. So
okay.
I helped them line up a couple of new hosts. Heather Wilson and Clint Esposito are now the new hosts, and I kind of helped line them up. And so I think they'll do a great job. But yeah, the podcast thing was a fun little extra thing for me to do. And I think it pushed me a little bit, because I'm not naturally like a, being up in front of people kind of person. I'm a little bit more of an introvert. So, it helped me with my writing too, because I feel like being able to think when you interview people like that on the fly helps you in those situations when you're interviewing someone for a story. And so I think it kind of helped me become more well-rounded as a writer.
Very cool, man. I love that. I love your story. Before I let you go, I want to talk about, through our text, we talked about, you told me you're very interested in music and you relate to my interest in music. So I want to know, like, what's your favorite kind of music and what's maybe like your favorite concert you've ever been to?
Well, I mean, favorite music, that's a tough one, man. Yeah. I'm sure you're the same. You have a specific genre that you're into, like hardcore kind of stuff, well, if I recall right.
I mean, everything from hair bands to classic rock and roll in general, whether it be Led Zeppelin and the Eagles to Guns N' Roses and Poison to Tool and Lamb of God, but it's all under the hard rock and roll genre. I'm pretty narrow-minded. I will admit, recently, I've really become a fan of Ed Sheeran. Don't tell anybody. But, you know, and then I mean, Christina Aguilera, like, I think she's one of the greatest voices of our generation, Adele. But for the most part, rock and roll.
I hear you. I mean, to me, like, I don't really care. I listen to any music that sounds good. Like, if it's classical, I love classical, too. I had some great classes in college that I took, which is a funny story on that. Like, I took this introductory to classical music thinking, you know, I think a lot of people go into the class like that thinking it's going to be really easy, right? Oh, it's an easy one. Mm. There's 150 people in it. By the end of that class, there was like 40 of us left because we had to study. You had to go home and listen for like hours and be able to recognize genres of music. Yep. And so it was just really cool to kind of learn all the different types of music. But I have to say I definitely gravitate towards like post-punk. Britpop is probably another one of my, like, I love Britpop, like the Idols, Sleeper Mods. Let's see, but harder side, King Gizzard by far is my favorite. I've seen him twice. Want to see him again if I can. King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Have you listened to them at all?
No. No, I'm literally writing it down right now.
They are prolific. I've never seen a band where I think, a couple years ago, I want to say they had this goal. They turned out 6 albums in 1 year. And I was like, how is this even possible? You know, like, it's hard to even keep up with them. They put out so many albums. I think they've done 14 albums now, maybe somewhere around there.
That's impressive.
Maybe,
yeah. Not,
maybe even more. But yeah, they do anything from like a Black Sabbath super hardcore to like techno. I mean, it's just like everything you can think of. And they're just absolutely incredible live, though. Like, 2 drummers in sync, like you've never seen before. Just, if you ever get a chance to see them live, you won't regret it.
Well, I will be searching them tonight, and yeah, I'll check them out. So, I always like discovering new music. But that's the best concert you feel like you've been to? Best band you've seen?
Yeah, that's probably one. There is a standout for me that goes way back to where, like, you know, growing up in Cleveland, the music scene was so incredible there. Like, mm-hmm. Every band stopped there coming through Cleveland. And so I got the opportunity to just see so many from hip hop. I remember seeing LL Cool J when I was in high school.
That's awesome.
You know, all the way through to probably my favorite all time lineup was Lovin' Rockets and the Dandy Warhols Warmed Up. And both of those are, you know, 2 of my biggest, you know, favorite bands from back in the 80s. And that was probably a bucket list one for me. And
sick.
Of course, recently I got to go meet Wesley Schultz from the Lumineers. My wife and I drove over to Bend, Oregon, and he took care of us, and it was, I can't think of enough. It was incredible. Like, he gave us the total VIP treatment, and I got to go back afterwards and meet him after the show and hang out with him. And he ended up talking to me for like 15 minutes. I mean, it's just such a cool, down-to-earth guy, and it was just a fantastic experience.
Dude, that's awesome, man. Anytime you get to do some stuff like that, it just, you like a fan like yourself or myself, you'll never forget that. It's something you'll have to hold on to. So love hearing the stories. Love your story, Dale. I appreciate you jumping on here and telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, like I said, I could go on. Maybe I will. I keep thinking about it, you know, maybe writing a little short book where, like, I feel like these little stories I have, I could probably, it'd make nice little short chapters to where I bet, you know, maybe yeah. Somebody read it.
So, yeah, of course. Well, if you decide to do that, let me know. We'll promote it, and I would love to read it. So, yeah, keep us in mind.
Yeah, you know how it is. Like, it's always like you're your own worst enemy, because I go, who would even want to read something like that? You know, you just talk yourself out of stuff, you know?
Sure, sure. So it's just you need to do it, man. You got some cool stories. You work for some cool companies. So, yeah, I think people would enjoy that.
I appreciate it, man. It's been good. I don't, no regrets, man. Like I said, 31 years now in this industry working, you know, not to mention all those early years of riding. So it's been a good ride. And, you know, now that I'm getting a little older, I feel like that's just what happens. You kind of start to look back and appreciate all the things that you've done, and maybe things you whined about in the past. You go, that's a pretty darn good situation I had there. And yep. Didn't even realize it.
Absolutely. All right, Dale. Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it. And we'll stay in touch.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. See ya.